You are listening to Murder Curry, and this is Tanay Modi bringing you one more killer crime story. What does your ideal psychopath look like? Do they have a weapon in their hands and a serial killerish look on their face? Well, the chances are that you must be imagining some crazed killer depicted in the movies like Zodiac, Seven, Silence of the Lambs, Murder 2. I hope not the last one. Research says that 1% of the world population fits the criteria of psychopaths. That may not sound like a lot, but when broken down, that means that one in every 100 people that you meet is a nutcase. The good news is that not every psychopath that exists is a crazed murderer. Psychopathy isn't contagious and neither is sociopathy, but one of the differences between the two is that one's circumstances makes them a sociopath, whereas psychopaths are genetically and naturally who they are. And someone who does things that we as a society or individually do not understand are ruled out as inhuman. This doesn't mean that even though whatever barbaric acts carried out by the people that I'm going to talk about today makes them less guilty of anything, but the fact alone that how emotionally and mentally contrasting these people are from the rest of the quote-unquote normal people is enough to spark curiosity in anyone. A true crime fanatic or not. Even today, in many remote areas of the world, cannibalism is absolutely fine in some eyes, and in some places, well, bats are also considered a great dish. Remember that one? The point being, no mind is similar, and one's rendition of what behavior is acceptable and which is not is where the line of morality is drawn. Eventually, what are we but not the wet slimy puddle of mass in our skulls? I have a scenario for you. Imagine that you witnessed someone you trusted and who was close to you committing a horrific crime. You'd say you have two options in front of you. One, you report them and move on. Or two, you remain silent and live with that on your conscience for the rest of your life. You may have not thought of this, but there is a third option. The kind that usually doesn't come to the mind of normal people, which is to join them in the nightmare and make a family business out of it. No, this ideology isn't coming from some Gujarati mech mafia, but from the real acts of senseless cruelty carried out by two sinister sisters. Horror wears many faces, but perhaps the most chilling of them all is the mask of ordinariness. There was nothing striking or unusual about any of the convicts of this case to set them apart as criminals. Here is an innocent-looking family of three, Renuka, Seema, and their mother, that on the surface did begging and petty jobs to break bread. While keeping their evil profile hidden, they could have been just another face in the crowd. Someone you caught a glimpse of at a railway station, a temple, or while maybe walking down a road, and forgot that you ever saw them. But their horrific past had previously brought them to the limelight, which shaped their present and left a noose-shaped question mark looming over their future. Within the context of poverty and crime, theorizing female criminality presents an additional problem, as crimes committed by women contradict the stereotypes of caregivers and nurturers, a perspective that the protagonists of this story thoroughly and mindlessly exploited throughout all of their operations for their benefit. The trio had made manipulating, abducting, and killing a family syndicate, which carried on from 1990 to 1996. This case is a true example of how dangerous a depraved mind can get. At the time of their judgment, the court had awarded the sisters with the ultimate verdict for committing unforgivable crimes under the counts of kidnapping 13 and murdering 9 children, which eventually made the sisters the only two women to be sentenced the capital punishment since 1955, that is, 46 years after such sentence was ever carried out to a female. If this hasn't blown your mind already, the sisters were only 23 and 21 at the time of their arrest and were deemed unsafe to live within society. Their actions from their horrific past shattered the perception of women capable of only being sympathetic housewives and created a turmoil among the people of India as they tried to comprehend the case of the sinister sisters and wondered among themselves while glaring into their cold-eyed mugshots, how could someone use young children for their personal benefits and then kill and discard them after they have served their purpose? A psychological thriller movie called Poshampa was released last year, which was inspired by their case, but the movie's plot is more fiction and dramatization than facts. Although still a movie about, there's no other way to put it, the mass murder of children, the actual abuse the trio of the females inflicted on the basis of this plot is no less than any thriller movie. The start of this story cannot be pinpointed to one exact specific onset. The pauses that I had to take in between the research to fully absorb the level of gruesomeness that they implicated were far less dramatic than the decade-long frenzied crime train the three journeyed on. Renuka Bai, aka Rinku, is the older half-sister between her and Seema, aka Devki. And their mother was Anjana Bai, the catastrophic matriarch of the family. If you thought Karens were infuriating, wait till you hear about Anjana Bai. She was born in 1932 in Pune, while in the same year, in the same city, the Pune Pact was signed in Yerwada jail by Gandhiji and Dr. Ambedkar to resolve the significant problem of caste discrimination, which at that time was in peak rebellion in places like Pune. Under the effect of the Great Depression in the 1930s, there was a chronic want of every essential requirement of human existence. There was a lack of sanitation and communication, all with the added peak of rebellion against the Britishers had created chaos. And as the records go, poverty was most intense during that part of colonial era India. Numerous famines and epidemics killed millions of people each coming year. And possibly, Anjana Bai first-hand witnessed that vicious era and might have had to provide for herself at a young age. She was known as someone as hard as nails, savage and ruthless, would do whatever it took to survive. It is only safe to assume that she had picked up these traits after growing up looking around at a harsh and persistent world. She had an instinct for theft and stealing, which eventually became a striking compulsion and a lifelong obsession. In these learning growing years, the young Anjana Bai had mastered the art of being the perfect petty thief. Coming face to face with run-ins with the law several times, she eventually became competent in evading or bribing herself out of the sticky situations. Years went by and she got married, although soon she developed illicit ties with a truck driver and eloped with him to Kolhapur. Well, not long after, at 42 years, Anjana Bai gave birth to elder daughter Renuka in 1973. Though, after she was born, the truck driver ran away and deserted her. 2 years of petty jobs later, she married Mohan, a retired soldier, and moved in with him in Nasik, and gave birth to her second daughter Seema in 1975 with him. Though Anjana Bai was never an average housewife, there were over 125 cases lodged against her for petty thefts. Fed up with the repeated harassment by the police, owning to Anjana Bai's life of crime, Mohan sent her and the two girls away and he too abandoned them to live his life separately. After this, Anjana Bai moved back to Pune, but with scarce resources and 2 kids to take care of, she now solely depended on what she knew best. Stealing and thieving was the new normal for the trio, as like a wildcat, she kept training her kittens, passing on her knowledge and skills of stealing and thieving to them. The two young girls had been nurtured with criminal activities of snatching chains and purses and pickpocketing in crowded places, and this was their only source of learning, as they couldn't afford to go to school and manage other resources with the only income coming from the stealing. Well, but at least they had the company of each other and their theft-crazed mother. You better hold on to your cup handles, because this is where the story is poured a hot, potent brew of darkness. When Renuka was 10, she met Kiran, a local boy working in a tailoring shop nearby. And in December of 1989, when she was 16, Renuka married him at a temple in Shirdi. However, this was already her second marriage and had given birth to a child when she was just 15. After months, Anjanabai took her daughters and moved to Nasik for some time, hoping to reconcile with Mohan. She took her two grown-up daughters to meet him as means of gaining sympathy, but instead got greeted with Mohan's new wife and daughter, and got to know that Mohan had remarried and already started a family. So, when that didn't work out, they resorted back to theft and returned to Pune in 1990. Well, around this time, Renuka's husband also started to support them. He used to rob vehicles from Pune and would use them to travel to nearby cities like Mumbai, Kolhapur and Kalyan for robbery. The Eureka moment happened to the gang in June 1990 when Renuka, along with her first child, went to a temple. There was a large gathering inside where Renuka was trying to pickpocket, but was caught in that process. Showing her presence of mind on being caught, she cunningly raised a hue and cry, and using her child as foil, she argued, "How can a woman with a child commit a crime?" Upon hearing this, the crowd let her go as they saw the image of a mother and a child, and later Renuka shared the incident with her mother and sister. After this, the conspiracy hatched that they would start kidnapping children of tender age, use them for begging, and if they got caught while committing thefts, they would use that child as means of arousing public sympathy in their favor, which would help frame them as innocent. They also logically discussed that the said children could become unwanted or inconvenient to their work. As a solution, they adopted a use and throw strategy, wherein they would discard of the children by killing them after they had served their purpose. The trio had officially changed their occupation from a cold-eyed pickpocketing crew into a violent and impulsive criminal gang who kidnapped and killed. With this horrifying new layout in their mind, they started their operation in 1990 itself after the trio had gone to Kolhapur, where Renuka met a female beggar sitting with her child at a bus stand. She managed to kidnap the child without being noticed by his mother and took the child to Shirdi, where they had gone on a streak of committing thefts. They named this child Santosh. At temple in Shirdi, Siva tried to snatch a handbag of a person, but she got caught and the person started making a ruckus about it. Anjanabai then intervened by deliberately throwing Santosh on the ground, who sustained a bleeding injury on his head, after which people rather consoled Santosh and Seema's matter was let go. On their way back, they wanted to do some more thefts, although Santosh was incessantly crying as he was bleeding. Thus, to the trio, he had deemed no longer useful, as his commotion would have only increased the likelihood of them being caught. And so, as per the discussed solution, Anjanabai came forward, pressed the mouth of Santosh and dashed his head multiple times on an iron bar, whereby Santosh sustained more head injuries and died on the spot. Anjanabai's clothes were washed at a water tap nearby and Santosh was disposed of at a bus stand in Kolhapur. Meanwhile, the sisters watched their mother's gruesome act while they were munching on a vada pav. Let me tell you, at this time, the two sisters would have only been 17 and 15. Let that sink in. They made Pune their second base after Nasik and kidnapped children of below 5 years from underprivileged people who were mainly beggars and stayed on the streets of Pune, which still has 40% of the population living in the slums. They targeted these children mainly because they knew that their families didn't have enough resources to look for them and would be turned a blind eye if they decided to report them missing. In another instance, at a mandir in Nasik, the trio saw a 2-year-old child sitting on the floor with her mother. They swooped in and took her away as soon as the mother went forward to have puja. They went to Pune with the kid, where Kiran had been staying at a cottage. The kid had been continuously crying, and after a while, the neighboring room started to inquire as to who she was, to which Renuka calmly replied that her mother had been admitted to the hospital and hence the child was brought to them. As the child became a nuisance when she wouldn't stop crying at all, Anjana Bai got very annoyed and she shoved this girl forcibly who hit her head. After this, they pushed her head into a latrine where the sisters held her legs together, and after some while, the movement stopped. They kept her body in a bag and threw it in a compound under bushes. Their cruelty knew no bounds. A 2-year-old was starved and beaten to death because his offense was that he would wail for his mother. In one instance, they actually watched a movie while a handbag lay between their legs, which contained a body of an 18-month-old that was chopped and bundled into it. After which, they threw it in the women's washroom of the theater. One day, a 3-year-old they kidnapped made a very big mistake of talking to passers-by about his parents. The trio got enraged from his behavior and hung the child upside down from the ceiling and used him as a punching bag, after which he met his end when his head continuously kept slamming against a wall. These were some of the cases which were proven in the court. Allegedly, their murderous rampage had taken the lives of around 40 young souls, wherein many of the cases, the two sisters would hold down the resisting child and Anjana Bai would deliver the blow with whatever she could get her hands on. To them, all these incidences were just the acts of serving to their personal purpose. They didn't have remorse or guilt for anything they did, and not once did the sisters look at their mother with an expression of uncertainty or hesitation at any point in their journey. It is unimaginable for any of us to even contemplate their state of mind, assuming how highly improbable it is that thoughts of self-reflection on their acts had ever crossed by them. In fact, it is scary enough to think that how ignorant their understanding of their acts might be while being deprived of resentment in themselves for what they did. Maybe they will never be able to understand that resentment that other people feel, and it will never exist in them. The sisters were given only one purpose in their life. They saw their mother not only as their unconditional family, but also as a role model, as she was their only teacher, who expected a single objective from them: becoming a better and efficient thief to survive. From the start of their lives, they had only known to rely on themselves and were mentored to do the worst things, and most positively in that process, they lost the grip on the difference between what is immoral and moral. They had seen days of meager resources, experienced a faulty family from the mistakes of their mother's dirty obsession, whose ill temper and actions had cost them everything in the past, and yet in their learning years, the sisters were only exposed to a mother who didn't think twice before squeezing lives out of children. In their minds, their mother maybe was their perfect savior. The agony and the pain they would have caused to the kidnapped children's families were far too inconsiderable for them compared to the appreciation of their mother after making something like this their only life goal. It is safe to assume that in them they are deprived of any kind of empathetic emotions, which subsequently made them ignore the gravity of their crimes, making them the near-perfect products of sociopathy. Although in 1994, a curious twist took place. The gang was in Thane, where Renuka saw a beggar holding a child. She gave her some money and told her to get some milk for the kid, after which she took the 9-month-old in her arms, and when the beggar went to get milk and was out of sight, she fled from there. One day, they took this kid to Nasik to use at Kumbh Mela. but the child would cry and then Anjanabai would beat him up. Fed up with its tantrums, she instructed to leave the child at a temple, after which they left. Apparently, Renuka was so fond of this child that she wanted to retrieve him. She desperately looked around and came to know that the child was in an orphanage and filled an application to get this child by stating that she was the mother. When this didn't work, she resorted to some fake litigation, but she wasn't successful in this effort too. This act was truly mysterious and very unlike them. During their active crime years, Renuka had given birth to 3 more children. The second was born in 1991 and the third in 1994. But tragically, the youngest one was born in 1996, 6 months before their mother's arrest. Their path towards their noose was determined when, out of jealousy and spite against Mohan, Anjanabai's second husband, the trio decided to abduct Mohan and his second wife's elder daughter. The sisters acted on this plan and later abducted their stepsister, after which they beat her up for a week at their Nasik home and then killed the child and disposed of the remains in a sugarcane field. When she was nowhere to be found, Mohan and his wife reported their child missing. Although his wife was convinced that it must be the work of the trio and filed a kidnapping case against them. But little did anyone know that investigating that one case would lead to the unraveling of a spate of crimes, unlike anything they had seen in their whole careers. After being done with the elder daughter, the gang had now Mohan and his wife's younger daughter in crosshairs. When they resurfaced to kidnap their second stepsister, the police arrested them and brought them in. The gang had very little luck with them, and with the formidable questioning, it was only a matter of time till their smart talk and arrogant answers were outsmarted. The trio was particularly stubborn, especially Anjanabai, who just sat there and stared and did not crack once. So they went after Seema, who was apparently the weak link, and got her to break down. Just as the police had hoped, she admitted to the kidnapping and killing, but said it was all under the orders of their mother. The police then sent a search team to their house in Nasik and uncovered evidence of more kidnappings, such as discarded clothing of children and the mysterious presence of several children in photographs of birthday party celebrations of Renuka's children, who were not locals and were unaccounted for. They quickly got the hint that this was something more sinister than they imagined it to be. This case is like a very dark version of Hansel and Gretel, wherein the two siblings work together with the witch to be more efficient in luring in kids. The gang had been finally nailed down and had no way of bribing their way out of the situation as they had kept doing before. As the police kept investigating, they kept on discovering more and more pieces of evidence connecting them to many cases of the missing children. With a much sinister hand at play, the CID took over the case and the murder trail began backtracking. While they found evidence that seriously implicated the gang, the CID needed a much stronger source to confirm the happenings of the crimes and to unearth how deep the coffin of crimes was buried. Eventually, the gang sensed that life behind bars was now inevitable, and the first one to break was Kiran, Renuka's second husband. Although it was suspected that he played a huge part in the whole operation, many times acting as the getaway vehicle driver and also having done some kidnappings, he got all the charges against him dropped when he converted himself into an approver and chose to testify against his whole in-laws family. He gave his statement as an approver that he had just been a silent spectator in all the heinous crimes and the only mastermind behind them was Anjanabai, and put very little blame on the sisters. A bolt of panic hit the sisters and their case in December 1997 when the formidable Anjanabai died at 65, leaving her daughters for themselves in between awaiting trial. But to make things worse, Kiran had to now change his statement that he only blamed the sisters for the crimes committed. The trials then started in 1998, in which the charges simmered down only to the two sisters. Except for the evidence presented against the sisters for the crimes, There were many startling revelations made in court about Kiran too. There was evidence of him with the trio having custody of some children whose bodies were found later. He admitted himself that he had bribed the police many times and saved the gang from clutches of law. He had also kept moving with the trio for a long period, and despite the repeated criminal acts committed by them, he did not inform the police or any authorities. Despite these statements, he was acquitted from all the charges since he had testified against the sisters. After 3 years of the trials, the sensational case had finally been given a verdict in 2001. 3,000 people had gathered in the court premises to hear the sentence in the murder case. Just at the age of 27 and 25, the sisters were proven of kidnapping 13 and murdering 5 children, for which they had been sentenced to the death penalty. Kiran touched his lawyer's feet after the verdict as he walked out unscathed from the whole case. It was reported that the sisters showed no sign of remorse when the verdict was announced. The sisters had to lawfully accept the punishment for their crimes, but they did not anticipate the real torture that was yet to rain down on them. Death row prisoners continue to face long delays in trials, appeals, and thereafter in executive clemency. During this time, the prisoner on death row suffers from extreme agony, anxiety, and debilitating fear arising from an imminent yet uncertain execution. Well, around 477 death penalties have already been pending as of 2020. In fact, only 8 men have been executed in the last 20 years, with the most recent execution carried out on 20th March 2020 of the convicts of the Nirbhaya case. The sisters were also separated after their verdict, for which every next day they showed their verbal disapproval and pleaded for being kept together under the promise of good behavior. Eventually, they were placed together, and then in 2006, they appealed for commuting their death sentence to life imprisonment under the reasons of long delays in execution. Much to their disappointment, the Supreme Court heard the case and rejected their plea, saying they were incapable of reform and were a proven menace to the society. Furthermore, except for the fact that they are women, they found no other mitigating circumstances in favor of the appealants, as the nature of the crime and the systematic way in which they operated amply demonstrated the depravity of their minds and how casually they took the killings. However, the sisters didn't yet give up on their optimism and sent a mercy petition to the late former president Mr. Pranab Mukherjee, but he too rejected their plea for mercy. Even now, they insist that they are innocent, and every time the jail superintendent visits, they want to know about the status of their mercy petition, as in their mind, there is no doubt about their sentence being commuted. Renuka wanted her children to have access to her bank accounts, but they were sealed and would fret over what would happen to her kids. Renuka's love for her kids is eerily confusing, given that she herself, in cold blood, preyed on and killed so many children. Renuka and Seema would now be 47 and 45, who still believe that they shouldn't be sent to the gallows because doing so would be more barbaric than what they deserved. Their other proposed argument is that they were very young during their crimes and were deprived of judgment by their mother in their tender age. In the movie Poshampa, a deliberate attempt is made to instill a debate of nature versus nurture when taking in regards the fate of the sinister sisters. Instead of viewing crimes as exceptional acts, it is necessary to understand that crimes are woven into the fabric of society, within which gender and age plays an important part. The crimes may be a butterfly effect of many social, economical, or cultural factors, but no matter what gender or age, the growth of humanity as community is in our hands. The death penalty eliminates the chance for offenders to redeem themselves. But are the people who are capable of carrying out something that shatters the basic essence of emotional premises that makes us a civilized community ever trustworthy of being redeemable? Well, that was all I could come up with for today. And as it goes without saying, share this podcast among your community and your views on this podcast with me on Instagram or anywhere you find this. Until next time, farewell.